Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, following on from the publication of Pope Benedict's new encyclical, we hear from the head of the Vatican's Council for Justice and Peace about its message for governments and business leaders. Plus, we take a look back at one of the documents which inspired it, Pope Paul VI's prophetic 1967 document, Populorum Progressio. And the Church in the United Kingdom celebrates the signing of a decree setting 19th century Cardinal John Henry Newman on the road to sainthood. Leaders of the world's wealthy nations meeting in the devastated Italian city of L'Aquila this week should heed the message contained in Pope Benedict XVI's new encyclical Caritas in Veritate, or Charity in Truth, released by the Vatican on Tuesday. The encyclical, Pope Benedict's third, calls for a radical rethinking of economic policies so that they are guided not simply by the logic of profit, but by an ethics which is people-centred. If profit becomes the exclusive goal, the document warns, it risks destroying wealth and creating poverty, leading to the scandal of glaring inequalities, even though the world's wealth is growing in absolute terms.
The causes of underdevelopment are not only causes of material order, but it's important, it's the lack of fraternity among men and peoples.
As president of the Vatican's Justice and Peace Council, Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino headed the team of experts presenting the new encyclical in the Vatican press room on July the 7th. I talked to him about the document's message for world leaders and the inspiration it draws from encyclicals of previous pontiffs.
Pope Benedict XVI intended to publish this encyclical 2 years ago, in 2007, to commemorate Paul VI's encyclical Populorum Progressio. And although the date has passed, but the reference to Populorum Progressio is constant in the encyclical of Benedict XVI, because it expresses admiration for what Paul VI had foreseen. And Benedict XVI completes with the experience of what has happened during the last 20 years. Because we know that the last social encyclical was Centesimus Annus of John Paul II in 1991. So it's important that also Populorum Progressio has become an encyclical that deserves commemoration as the commemoration of the Rerum Novarum. So we had Popes Pius XI, Quadragesimo Anno, Paul VI, Octogesimo Anno, John Paul II, Centesimus Annus. So Populorum Progressio has already had the Sollicitudo Rei Socialis of John Paul II in 87, after 20 years of Populorum Progressio. And this one, as we know, is also commemorating and celebrating the Populorum Progressio of Paul VI. So what is in the encyclical? It is a reference to those things that have happened during these 20 years since Centesimus Annus. So, and especially is the globalization and all the problems of globalization. And so, of course, the encyclical refers also to the recent economic crisis and also especially stressing that economy is important, but as it is an human activity, it must respect moral, ethical rules. And so it cannot go without any control. We have experienced how an economy, a finance, without control, goes bankrupt.
At the heart of the new encyclical is the belief that every economic decision has a moral consequence and that financiers must rediscover the genuinely ethical foundations of their activities. It stresses that justice must be applied to every phase of economic activity, from locating resources and financing to production and consumption. The encyclical notes that the true development of peoples depends above all on a recognition that the human race is a single family working together for the common good, rather than groups of individuals in competition with each other. Cardinal Martino again.
It is about the integral development of the human being, and so it recalls the encyclical also the Humane Vitae and Evangelii Nuntiandi of Paul VI, and it is important because it reaffirms the necessity of defense of life, the defense and also of the religious freedom, the two human rights which are fundamental of the other human rights. And so since the development, the progress is evocation, this is the reason why the Church intends and intervenes in the questions of the development. And so it says that the development is a vocation. It's not only something material, something. No, it responds to a vocation that must be responded. And the vocation is a gift. And so this vocation implies also the centrality of the charity, of love. Because the causes of underdevelopment are not only causes of material order, but it's important, it's the lack of fraternity among men and peoples. If we consider the others as brothers and sisters, we can certainly be more open to help them.
This encyclical, as the other letters of this kind, are addressed to all people of goodwill. And yet, would you say that this particular document is meant in a special way for those world leaders who are tackling the current economic crisis, the world leaders meeting at the G8 summit, for example?
Oh, yes. Practically, Benedict XVI has sent a letter to President of the government Berlusconi, a letter which is a condensed of the encyclical. And yes, we hope that this encyclical will be received with interest by all political leaders. And it's important because the important entities which make the economy is the market, the governments, and the civil society. And so this is important, because the market cannot be left without control. We saw the crisis. And so they need to be controlled. By whom? By governments. And so the governments have to have this clear perception about the rules to set up, and also the need of the civil society to intervene.
Karen. Caritas in Veritate also focuses on the need for decent employment for all, providing for families and promoting the development of communities and nations. Lowering the level of protection for workers' rights, it says, or abandoning mechanisms of wealth redistribution in order to increase a country's international competitiveness hinders the achievement of lasting development. While that may sound to a secular ear rather like a utopian socialist vision that flies in the face of capitalism and the demands of the global marketplace, Cardinal Martino says it's not possible to categorise the Pope's thinking simply into left or right wing, liberal or conservative, because it is based above all on our response to God's loving plan for humanity.
The category is the social doctrine of the Church, which is not a Marxist one, which is not a liberal one. Although the encyclical says clearly that the market is important, because if there would not be profit in the market, nobody would put anything for sale. There would be no interest. But, and here the Church intervenes, the market must be controlled. There must be clear and precise rules in order to control the market, the participation of the workers into the business, because the businessman must not consider his own and whatever enterprise he or she has, because there are a lot of people who participate. And starting from Pope the VI, who defined the worker an entrepreneur, because the worker must participate in order to enjoy what he is doing, and of course also to enjoy the profit.
Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino is president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. The day he signed the new encyclical, Pope Benedict himself stressed how profoundly inspired he was by the themes of social justice contained in Populorum Progressio, the prophetic document of his predecessor, Pope Paul VI. Published at Easter 1967, that encyclical opens with words that are as relevant today as they were when they were written over four decades ago. The progressive development of peoples is an object of deep interest and concern to the Church. This is particularly true in the case of those peoples who are trying to escape the ravages of hunger, poverty, endemic disease, and ignorance. The hungry nations of the world cry out to the peoples blessed with abundance. And the Church, cut to the quick by this cry, asks each and every man to hear his brother's plea and answer it lovingly. The document was partly the result of the Pope's own travels, a revolutionary idea back then, to Latin America, Africa, India, and the Holy Land. There he saw with his own eyes the grinding poverty, sickness, and desperation that contrasted so sharply with the economic progress and fast-growing consumer culture of Western countries. There he saw the urgent need for the Christian message of love, compassion, justice and equality, to act as a social conscience and to speak out against the growing gap between rich and poor.
I think that whole sense of a social conscience is really important, and it's really important that churches and faith leaders can speak out on these issues, especially speaking out from the perspective of people who are poorest and marginalised.
Christine Allen is director of the London-based international development charity Progressio, which draws its inspiration from Pope Paul's visionary encyclical. Though it was founded during the Second World War in response to the rise of fascism in Europe, the organisation today focuses on projects with partners across the developing world.
In the 1960s in particular, we developed a very much kind of Africa focus, replacing people to work with local organisations and churches. And that developed into a very professional international volunteering placement. So now we place more than 80 development workers, we don't call them volunteers, to do training, skills development, capacity building with overseas partners in 11 different countries around the world, including mainly Latin America, but Africa and the Middle East as well.
If you look closely at the document Populorum Progressio, Pope Paul VI talks about his own journeys, his own experiences of seeing people in Latin America, Africa, India and the Middle East as part of his inspiration for that document. Do you think it would have been possible for him without this first-hand experience to write that kind of encyclical?
Well, personal contact is very important, and I think we have to remember 40 years ago, the world was quite different in terms of technologies, in terms of people's awareness of what was going on in the world. Today, you know, through the click of a computer screen, we can see, we can be engaged with realities, you know, around the world. And so it is a much quicker and a much more engaging sort of spread of information. Clearly, in 1967, that wasn't the issue. You know, people, the flow of information was much slower, and there wasn't that sort of sense of engagement. But at the same time, it comes out very clearly in the document how much the Pope had been moved by his experiences. And we know from our experiences of development workers and our own travel meeting partners that kind of personal contact is just invaluable. It's immeasurable almost. But at the same time, you know, you don't have to travel around the world to be able to have that kind of contact. And at the end of the day, I think it's about an empathy. It's about a sympathy. It's about a sense of solidarity that's deep within your being, which is quite a gospel sort of thing in the way that Jesus was moved to tears on those sorts of occasions. And so I think, yes, it's very clear that the Pope's real hand experience clearly had an impact, but also I think there was an openness there to being in touch with people and to feeling that common humanity, which perhaps we can find other ways of accessing in today's world.
The Pope also draws on social encyclicals written by his predecessors, doesn't he? But what do you think are perhaps the most innovative parts of Populorum Progressio? Why would you say perhaps it has still such a relevance for us today?
Catholic social teaching is always quite contextual, so what's written in 1967 isn't always relevant 40 years later. But I think one of the interesting things about Populorum Progressio is just actually how relevant and how challenging it still is. And for those people that know about Catholic social teaching, in some respects the radical nature of church teaching isn't a surprise. But if you haven't come across Catholic social teaching before, which I hate to say, rather too many Catholics haven't, but if you haven't, I mean, reading that document, it's incredibly radical. It's incredibly challenging. I mean, the fact that it talks about a structural analysis to poverty. It talks about a full vision of development, one that includes peace, one that includes cultural self-determination, one that talks about choices, one that talks about people being able to control their own destinies. It's talking about this concept of full humanism, which is about saying everybody should strive to that. You know, Catholics don't have a monopoly. Everybody strives towards that full humanism. And this openness to working with others, I think, is incredibly challenging. Here in the UK at the moment, we're debating about Trident. And, you know, there's an ironic kind of passage in there that actually talks about the Pope seeking a world fund, which will be funded by reductions in military spending. You know, the kind of challenges and debates that are extremely radical. It's no wonder the Catholic social teaching is the Church's best-kept secret.
As you say, it contains very many visionary ideas regarding development, regarding even issues like trade justice. And if we look at the movement for fair trade, which has suddenly become very popular and very widespread, but why did it take so long, I suppose the question is, for these ideas to take root?
Well, I think the answer to why it takes so long is linked into what we've just been discussing, which is the radical nature of it. It's an incredibly radical challenge. You know, it's very clear in this document about, you know, a new conscience of our times, you know, that very sense of asking people to think radically and differently about your life. Now, I mean, in some respects, we're probably more aware of poverty and injustice in today's society than perhaps people were in 1967. So, you know, it was going to be even more radical in those times. So I think there is something about, yes, it was ahead of its time. Catholic social teaching has always been a little bit ahead of its time. I mean, Pope Leo XIII in 1891 was talking about the rights of workers when the labour movement was effectively in its infancy. Popolo and Progressio doesn't just talk about right trading relationships. He also talks about debts. He talks about reductions in military expenditure and the relationship between development and peace, issues that we're still struggling with, you know, and issues about when you do engage in development partnerships, that you do it with, there's a lovely phrase that when it talks about kind of how people engage with the development process, that they go to serve and to collaborate, not as masters. When experts come with expertise, they must season it with love, you know, and recognizing the challenges that very often that missionary organizations and churches perhaps hadn't always operated in that way, but that's the way in which we should do it.
Christine Allen is Executive Director of the London-based international development charity Progressio, which draws its inspiration from Pope Paul's visionary encyclical, Populorum Progressio. Here in the Vatican on July the 3rd, Pope Benedict signed a decree recognising a miracle attributed to the intercession of the 19th century British cardinal, John Henry Newman. Though no date or location has yet been announced, this move paves the way for Cardinal Newman's beatification, the first post-Reformation English figure to be set on the road to sainthood.
For me personally, I'm just highly delighted, and I think everybody in the diocese will be.
William Kenny is Auxiliary Bishop and Apostolic Administrator of the Diocese of Birmingham in central England, where Newman spent most of his life, first as an Anglican priest, then after his reception into the Catholic Church as a Catholic priest and later cardinal. Bishop Kenny talked to my colleague John Kelly about the impact that the beatification will have on the church in England and in his archdiocese in particular.
Well, it means that one of the greatest names in English Christianity is now going to be beatified. And as I say, he's closely associated with this diocese. He lived basically all of his life in Birmingham, at the Oratory, of course, and even before that had been living in Birmingham. And so he will, as I say, he's closely associated, his Catholic life is closely associated with this part of the world. And then, of course, he was received into the church in Oxford, which is also part of this diocese, by Blessed Dominic Barbary, the Passionist, and therefore that also is part. So, if you like, all of his Catholic life is associated here, and that, I say, it is just marvellous for the diocese.
So you mentioned his Catholic life. Of course, he converted to Catholicism. What impact will this beatification have on ecumenical relations?
I don't think it'll have any negative impact at all. John Henry Newman is regarded by both the Anglicans and ourselves as a very holy man, definitely a gifted theologian and preacher, and therefore they, I think, in the present ecumenical climate, will see it very positively as well.
Of course, his influence and his writings have spread far beyond the church. And why do you think this is?
Because I think he spoke to the people of his time. He was very well aware of what was going on in society. And, I mean, I just quite newly attended a lecture in Oxford given by Alistair MacIntyre, the philosopher from the United States, and he there spent a whole lecture on Newman's idea of the university, which I must say he did in typical scholastic form, of first putting the objections to what Newman says, and I sat there thought, well, those objections are pretty devastating, but of course, the good philosopher he is, he managed then to show us that Newman was relevant even in our times.
When Newman was writing, of course, he was writing at the time of the 19th century, all the great empiricists. And
yes,
he wrote in his Grammar of Assent, he kind of presented a logical argument. Do you think that would, how do you think that would fit in with a modern time, with the militant atheism of people like Richard Dawkins and so on?
Well, I think part of the problem of some of the militant atheists, please note what I say, some, not all, you know, is that they do not use logical argument, and therefore there's very little point in quoting Newman to them. But that for those who do, I think that is a very fruitful source of being able to reason about the about modern problems, because Newman addresses many of them. And as you rightly say, the some of those problems have returned in our time to be discussed yet again. I think Newman is very relevant for those. Some of his way of expressing things, of course, let's be honest, it's 150 years ago, and therefore some of it is not, the language is not the language we would use today. But I don't think that's a major problem, at least among academics.
The Archbishop of Westminster, His Grace Vincent Nicholls, said he hoped that Cardinal Newman would help us greatly in the task of protecting faith amidst the difficulties he foresaw. And what do you think these difficulties he foresaw were? Can you give us any idea of them?
I think part of it is the materialism of our present time. Then, as you say, the rather militant atheism, which is almost, funnily enough, is showing all the signs of being a religion. And I think that those are some of the difficulties that of faith that we have. Also, Newman, not least in his ideas of the development of doctrine, and the whole of his development, of his own development, and the development he saw in the church, is of course very relevant for our times. So I imagine that those were the difficulties that Archbishop Vincent was talking about. But I mean, you really do have to ask him. I'm not here to interpret Archbishop Vincent.
Cardinal Newman, he was basically an opponent to the idea of papal infallibility at the First Vatican Council,
yes.
even right down to the idea of the Pope making someone a saint. Do you think he'd find a certain irony in being beatified now, or how do you think he'd interpret this?
I'd say two things to that. The one is, of course, you're quite correct in what you're saying, but he also, when it was declared, immediately made his own submission to that declaration. I think we have to remember that, you know. But yes, I think Newman would laugh at the irony of it without any doubt whatsoever. He was always a very human man as well. And not only was he an academic, but he did spend a lot of his time in Birmingham doing ordinary pastoral work, the ordinary pastoral work of a priest. And he obviously also enjoyed that, and therefore he would have seen the irony and the humanity of our lives here.
And there was some controversy a while ago with the attempted exhumation of the remains and the removal of his body. And what effect do you think this has had?
As far as I know, none whatsoever. It was a controversy taken up by a very small group of homosexual people, by no means representative even of what I might term as the homosexual community. Then, of course, as you are probably aware, when the exhumation took place, there was nothing there, which I gather from the experts was what they would have expected given the ground that Newman was buried in. But we know we were at the right place because the plaque from the coffin was there, and I think some tassels from the from his cardinal's hat. But I don't think that is going to have any effect whatsoever.
And my thanks there to Auxiliary Bishop William Kenny, Apostolic Administrator of the Diocese of Birmingham in the United Kingdom. He was talking to my colleague John Kelly. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again, if you can, at the same time tomorrow, or find all our news and feature programmes on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.